Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:05 p.m. on Thursday, February 1st, 2018, in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Eastman, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Tarr, Representative Johnston, and myself, Representative Sponholz, Chair. And Representative Edgman, sorry, I was looking down. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Take a moment to silence your phones if you haven't already done so, so we can have a smooth committee. Before we begin, I want to thank Butch Carber, the House Hess Secretary from Records, and Madison Truitt, as always, from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today we'll be hearing three bills. The first up is HB 313 by Representative Gren, dealing with the recovery payment by insurance providers. Second, we'll be hearing House Bill 296 by Representative Klayman, covering youth marijuana use prevention program funding and looking to the will of the committee on that legislation. And then third, we'll hear HB 268 by Representative Guerra that details information distribution related to opioid prescription and look to the will of the committee on that bill. All right, would Representative Gren and Shea Siegert, staff to Rep. Gren, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and introduce the legislation.
Thank you, Chair Sponholz and members of the committee. I do apologize. I'm in the middle of Finance Committee as I snuck out and came down here, so I will have to run back up there. But I wanted to say thank you for the indulgence to hear this bill. House Bill 313 would implement a statute of limitations of 18 months on health insurance companies to recoup mistakenly paid amounts from health care providers in Alaska. A common practice of many health insurance companies is to perform an audit to make sure that the claims are paid accurately, a practice that any business trying to become more efficient would perform. In cases where the insurance company made an overpayment to the healthcare provider, the insurance company would seek to recoup the overpaid amount. The amount sought would either be paid by the healthcare provider or the patient. Currently in Alaska, there is no statutory time limit by which this retroactive recovery of indemnities must occur, keeping both providers and patients on the hook for an indefinite amount of time. With 32 states having implemented a statute of limitations for insurance company to retroactively recoup indemnities from healthcare providers, precedence has shown to serve as a best practice standard across the country to protect our healthcare providers and consumers of healthcare in Alaska. And to account for special circumstances, HB 313 provides exceptions to the 18-month limitations in instances of fraudulently supplemented claims, duplicate claims, instances of misrepresented or wrongly identified services by the health care provider, claims subject to adjustment by another health care insurer, or any payments or claims that are subject to legal action. By encouraging efficiency of health insurers, predictability for providers, and protections for patients, House Bill 313 serves as a fix to a large risk that resides in the current statute surrounding our health billing structure. Again, thank you for this chance to express our passion for this bill, and with the chair's indulgence, I would hand the microphone to my staff, Shea Siegert, to answer any questions or go through explanation of sections of House Bill 313.
Before we turn over things over to Shea Siegert, we need to move the CS before the committee so that we can make sure that's been taken care of.
Madam Chair, I move that the Health and Social Services Committee adopt the blank committee substitute for House Bill 313, work order number 30-LS0852/J as a working document.
All right, and I'll object for the purposes of discussion, and then that moves takes it to you, Representative. Thank you. Shea Siegert.
So through the chair, members of the committee, what we did with the CS for House Bill 313 is we added a Section 3, and so what that does is makes Title 39, which affects a larger scale of insurance plans in the state of Alaska, and made it subject to the provisions in Title 21. And so what was brought to our attention was that if we only affect Title 21, we'll only affect a small number of plans in the state of Alaska. And so we had to tie in Title 39 to be subject to Title 21 in this instance.
Perhaps you would describe the distinction between 21 and 39.
Yeah, so Title 39 it has to do with our state employees' benefits, our insurance plans provided through Alaska Care, and Title 21 has to do with all other plans and has to do with doing business if you're an insurance company in the state of Alaska. So Title 39 has to do with insurance companies that have contracted with the state for state employee benefits.
All right. Thank you. All right. Is there any questions for Mr. Siegert? All right. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And through the chair. Now, what is the timeline that you anticipate a claim would take before it becomes the subject of legal action, which you have mentioned a couple times in the bill?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I would have to defer to somebody within the institution. I do not know offhand. I'm sure it changes from case to case as to the timeline of which a claim would be subject to legal action. Under administrative code, so 3AAC 2610, which should be in a portion of your bill packet, and if it's not, I can provide it at a later date. It says a healthcare insurer shall give a written notice to a healthcare provider, healthcare facility, or consumer at least 30 calendar days before insurer seeks recovery for overpayment. The notice must include adequate information, so on and so forth. A healthcare insurer may not initiate recovery of an overpayment more than 365 days after the date of the original payment was made to a healthcare provider, healthcare facility. And so that explains what we're trying to do in this bill through administrative code, but this only affects under Title 21. But above that, it says, if a person who is required to include a coordination of benefits provision under AS 2142-205 provides coverage on a secondary basis, absent evidence of fraud, the secondary insurer must accept the... You know what, through the chair, Representative Eason, I'll have to check it with our legal team on that.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
So just looking at the language of the bill in this version J, you're talking about a healthcare insurer seeking recovery from a provider, correct? Is that the idea?
Through the chair, yes.
Follow-up? Then follow-up through the chair. If I was a provider and I didn't want to pay the amount, it would seem to me there would be some incentive for me to simply wait out the healthcare insurer for those 18 months and then point to this statute and say, you can't seek recovery. It's past 18 months. Not that I would personally do that, but there might be people who do. Is there something that would keep that sort of situation from ever happening?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, our intent for this bill was to give notice of the initial search of the recovery of funds before that 18 months. And so after they give the initial request for more funds, we would expect that they would do so in a timely process. And through the chair, Representative Eastman, I believe that that would have to do with regulations put forth by the regulating body. Through the chair, I can check for you, though.
Okay, thank you.
Are there other questions? Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to just kind of wrap my head around this. Mm-hmm. So what are the ramifications, then, if it's not done within the 18-month time period?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, then they will not be able to seek recovery for those funds.
And that's for any case? Are there any exceptions to that?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, there are. So for a claim that was submitted fraudulently, a payment that was made for a duplicate claim, healthcare services identified in the claim that were not actually delivered to by the healthcare provider, payments or claims subject to adjustment by another health care insurer. And number five would be a payment or claim that is the subject of legal action.
Okay. And follow up, Madam Chair? I know just from past claims, I guess on a personal level, many times when you're working through a claim through your physician's office and the insurance company, it takes a long time to get things procured and finished. Why 18 months? Why not 24 or 36?
So through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, so we contacted multiple people and then also looked at other states. So currently three states have a six-month provision, 12 states have a 12-month provision, and seven states have an 18-month provision. Right. And we felt like this would be the most fair and adequate timeline for someone after all payments had been made, when these insurance companies are making an audit of their business transactions, then they can go back and recover these claims, which is a fair business practice. But we felt as though after all transactions had been settled, the insurance company had paid the provider had, or the patient had paid the insurance company, then after all of those transactions had happened, the insurance company would have 18 months to have that audit happen and ask, also initiate the seeking or the search of these indemnities.
I have a follow-up, actually. Could you just restate? You said three states have a six-month limit, 12 states have a 12-month limit. How many states had an 18-month?
Seven states have an 18-month limit.
All right. So that's sort of 18 months seems to be sort of the outside limit of what most states that are regulating this are allowing for.
Chair, there's actually eight states that have 24 months and then two states. Connecticut has 60 months. Florida has 30 months.
Wow. Okay. So it's in the sweet spot in the middle.
Yes.
Okay. Are there other questions for Mr. Siegert? All right. So with the changes that were explained by Representative Gren and Mr. Siegert, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection to adopting the CS. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS? All right. Seeing none that it's been adopted, and we're going to go ahead, I guess, seeing none, the CS has been adopted, and we're going to take it at ease here for a second. Let's see. I think, is there anybody in the room that wants to testify on HB 313? Okay, you're available for questions. All right, super, thank you. We have on the off-net, we have Deborah Reeser from Spectrum Medical Billing Services in Anchorage. Ms. Reeser?
Yes.
Could you state your name and affiliation for the record and then give the rest of your testimony?
Sure. Through the chair and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Reeser, and my affiliation is Spectrum Medical Billing Services, a business that I own.
Would you like to proceed with your testimony?
Sure. Excuse me. I'm nervous. I don't even see anybody in my room. I own Spectrum Medical Billing Services, and I provide medical billing services to approximately 100 providers. The bulk of those providers are small practices, with probably 90% of those being moms, you know, that have families and try to make ends meet for themselves as far as providing occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, to a lot of patients that experience disabilities, whether it be Downs or autism or cerebral palsy. So the problem that I see that I've seen with some of these providers, and it usually happens at least once a year, is, for example, in 2016, a Cigna requested a refund of $1,200 from a provider that they kept paying beyond when the patient was eligible for coverage. So, yeah, I mean, that's fair. I'd be willing to get that back, but 3 years later, they're just now coming back and requesting that money back. There's been other instances as well. There's one recently, 2018, that they requested money back from a 2015 claim. 2017, they requested 2015. And it's frustrating that as far as the providers, they have a limited amount of time that they can file claims for services. So depending on the policy and the insurance company, it's anywhere from 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, and to file claims. So in turn, you know, the provider really needs to push to get those claims out, but yet it really doesn't seem fair that in turn the insurance company can come back 2 or 3 years later and say, you know, we did that wrong, that we want the money back. It would be beneficial then if they could do that within that time period too. I would say 1 year, but I mean, I'd accept 18 months as well. Because at that point, then the provider needs to try to go to the family, and maybe the family is not even in town anymore. So either the family's going to have an unexpected hardship, or the provider might have to just eat that money themselves. I've been a little bit scattered on my testimony, but I would love to see this get changed. I've just seen it too many times now with the providers having to pay the money back, and legally, they need to pay the money back. So I guess that ends my testimony. I'm open to any questions.
Thanks for your testimony, Ms. Reeser. Are there any questions for Ms. Reeser while we have her? I guess I'll just sort of comment. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that there's a limited amount of time to file a claim, but there's not an unlimited amount of time to collect on an overpayment of a claim. So it seems like a sort of a one-sided relationship.
Through the chair, that is correct.
All right. Thank you for that. Is there any other questions for either Mr. Siegert or Ms. Reeser while we've got her? All right. Seeing none, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for today. And then before we move to the next segment of this meeting, I'm going to just note we're going to be working on HB 296. And given that I'm chair of the board of the Alaska Children's Trust, which is detailed in HB 296, I'm going to go ahead and turn the gavel over to Representative Tarr for this section of the meeting. She's graciously agreed to chair for this section.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as we transition into House Bill 296, we'll first have the bill sponsor and staff come before us. So please, Rep. Klayman and Sarah Perman, if you could please come forward, put yourself on the record, and give us a brief recap of the legislation. This is the second meeting, I believe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Klayman, Alaska State Representative for House District 21 in West Anchorage. Thank you for hearing House Bill 26 again today. To reiterate, the purpose of this bill is to direct a portion of the state's marijuana excise tax toward marijuana education and prevention efforts. This year, the state collected more than $6 million from the excise tax. While 50% of the tax revenue is directed toward recidivism efforts via the Recidivism Reduction Fund, the other $3 million is currently not being directed to any specific purpose. In directing this money toward marijuana education efforts, we aim to remain in front of the curve, taking a proactive approach to marijuana education rather than a reactive approach to marijuana misuse. And with that, I believe my staff has some additional comments.
Sure. For the record and to the committee, my name is Sarah Perman. I'm staff for Representative Klayman. I just wanted to briefly kind of go into the details of the bill one more time. The bill creates a fund, the Marijuana Use Prevention, Education, and Treatment Fund, which is 50% of the general excise tax from marijuana sales. And this fund may be appropriated an equal amount, up to 50%, to Department of Health and Social Services and a grant program administered by the Alaska Children's Trust. The Department of Health and Social Services program, called the Marijuana Use Education and Treatment Program, goes to five parts: a community-based misuse prevention component, public education, surveying public attitude and knowledge, monitoring public health status, and substance abuse screening, intervention, and treatment programs, all related to marijuana. And then the Children's Trust grant program then gives grants to out-of-school programs that have a marijuana use prevention curriculum. They also have an adult and peer mentoring component and positive recreational activities. And the purpose, they either directly or indirectly focus on reducing initiation of marijuana usage, promoting the cessation of marijuana usage, reducing access to marijuana, and reducing exposure to secondhand dangers from marijuana. And with that, we can move forward.
Thank you for the recap of the bill. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm trying to get my head wrapped around the intent of the initial tax on marijuana. The intent, as I understood it, was that it, you know, a portion of that would go into the general fund, and then another portion would also go into treatment, and now we're taking part of that and then divide it into another quarter. So I'm just trying to, what was the intent of the initial tax, if you'll just remind me? Sorry, Representative Clayton.
Through the Chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, when we passed the legislation about what to do with the tax, we created the Recidivism Reduction Fund. At least my memory is that wasn't part of the ballot initiative that legalized recreational marijuana. Didn't create that fund. That was something that was done by the legislature. And so that was 50%, and then the remainder was open-ended in that legislation. And so this would use up not the other quarter, but the remaining 50 cents.
Okay, Madam Chair, just to follow up. So I guess I just remain a bit concerned on that. I'm looking at the intent either from the ballot measure itself, but also the intent of the tax and where those funds would go, how they would be dispersed. I could see kind of opening a box of everybody wanting a little piece of that pie. And anyway, I'm just still watching this closely. Mr. Klayman, thank you.
It's fine.
Any other questions from committee members? Representative Keto.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Representative Klayman, and I guess it's just kind of a follow-up on my comment from our last hearing, but and a follow-up from Representative Sullivan Leonard's question, too. It did seem to me when we had the marijuana initiative before us that there was some discussion of, as the revenue grew, that the revenue coming into the state would be able to be used to balance some of the fiscal issues we're having. And that was just my comment about taking 100% of the revenue versus a smaller amount. And so that's just wanted to make sure that that was still on the record.
Any response?
I think our response remains the same, which is that prevention is using those funds for prevention is a way to actually save the state money in the long run. But I recognize that different people take different perspectives on that question.
Representative Johnston has a question.
Yes, to follow up on the last two with my frog.
I'm trying to get there, too. Mine isn't quite normal either.
Had you considered when you were drafting this of doing a stepped-up approach? Because it seems, in talking to the program, to the Children Trust, I mean, it's going to be a grant-based program. And we don't know yet of the numbers of grants that will be coming in, the type of grants, you know, whether it will be a program that will be well-received and well-established and well-benchmarked. And so as a sponsor, I'm wondering if you were thinking of if maybe to take as far as having all the revenues going the first year, if you'd look at a stepped-up program.
Through the Chair, Representative Johnston, we never viewed this as an appropriations bill, and so that appropriations decision is ultimately left to the legislature as a whole. And if the legislature, in light of what is at some level an aspirational goal and not a mandatory dedicated fund, if the legislature wanted to start it more slowly, that would be, I think, something within the legislature's discretion.
And follow up on that, this is Sarah Perman for the record. It says it's subject to appropriation from the legislature, and the other part of note it says the legislature may make equal appropriations, but it does not say of 50%. I think it means up to that full amount. Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members? Okay. Seeing none, then we have a number of individuals who are signed up for invited testimony. And so if we could have Ms. Alana Humphrey, the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Alana Humphrey, CEO of Boys and Girls Clubs of South Central Alaska, one of two traditional and five military Boys and Girls Club organizations in our state, which collectively serve more than 20,000 youth through club membership and community outreach at 45 club sites in 26 Alaska communities in the hours that are out of school time. Boys and Girls Clubs recognize the importance of resources to provide primary and secondary prevention programs in the hours between 3 and 6 p.m. and during the day in the summer, the most dangerous times of day for youth and teens. It is during those times that kids may be unsupervised and far more likely to engage in behaviors that put them at risk for tobacco, alcohol, drug use, including marijuana. The importance of structured after-school time is well documented, and Boys and Girls Clubs in Alaska use time-tested quality standards that are based on the principles of youth development, child safety, and club experience research data analysis. But we don't stop there. We also ensure that the programs and activities offered at clubs are sensitive to the needs of the youth and community. Clubhouse directors and staff work closely with community leaders to carve a culturally relevant path for success for their youth, and much care is given to addressing the specific needs of each community of kids we serve. Despite preliminary results from the 2017 Alaska Youth Behavior Risk Survey indicating improvements in Alaska teen connectedness, a protective factor, and declines in tobacco, alcohol, and other drug use, including marijuana, we still see far too many young people with a decreased perception of risk related to using tobacco, alcohol, marijuana, and other drugs. We expect to continue to see that perceived risk decline with the introduction of recreational marijuana use for adults. In every Boys and Girls Club community, keeping kids safe from drug, alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana use is a shared community goal. There is still much to be done to ensure the safety and success of our youth. With additional resources, such as those indicated in HB 296, after-school programs could increase service hours, provide more mentors, provide additional programming, and extend our reach. I encourage you to move forward with HB 296. I'm available for questions should there be any.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And if I mispronounced your first name, which I think I did, I apologize. Are there any questions for Ms. Humphrey? Okay, I'm not seeing any questions, so thank you so much for your testimony this afternoon. Next, we're going to go to Terrence Robbins from Southeast Prevention Services in Ketchikan.
Hello. My name is Terrence Robbins with Southeast Prevention Services in Ketchikan. I'm a former program director for a drug-free communities program here, community grant. And I just wanted to point out a couple of things in support of this House bill. The Drug-Free Communities Program grants are currently in Ketchikan, Sitka, and Palmer. Sitka just started. Ketchikan's in its fourth of 5 years, and Palmer is in its seventh. Sometimes you can renew. DFC program funds cannot be used to support after-school program to pay for it. So there's a hole there. Local taxes, Ketchikan has some local taxes on marijuana sales, but they're so low they don't really provide enough money to do marijuana prevention. And they're just going into the general funds of our local government. Local youth use in Ketchikan is two times that of cigarette use. The Marijuana Control Board enforcement team has a very limited staff, and they're not capable of a really good compliance check program at retail stores throughout Alaska. And I've been trying to help out statewide on some of the opioid stuff, and one of the things that came up in our town hall in Ketchikan was treatment options in beds for substance use disorders in Alaska are very limited and they're very expensive. So I feel it'd be a great use of our marijuana tax dollars to put the money into prevention efforts rather than dealing with treatment down the road. So I'm available for any questions if you have any. Otherwise, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Robbins. Are there questions for the testifier? Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I actually just sort of had a comment. One of the things that you mentioned was the you sort of connected the dots for me as it related to opioids, and we know that we have a very serious opioid problem in the state of Alaska, and that we have a lot of young people that are starting to use opioids at a pretty young level. I hadn't connected the dots really for yet with this project and addressing that issue. But the number of people that we can, you know, if we can reduce even a few kids overdosing from opioids and going down a path which is very dangerous and life-threatening, then I think that's, you know, it's a pretty positive thing. The other thing you noted is that this program would help to fill in the hole which exists with the drug-free communities grants, which don't allow for after-school funding, and that that after-school time really is the riskiest time. We know that's the time when petty crimes by youth tend to be committed. We know that that's the time when a lot of young people are you know, experimenting in a lot of other ways, and keeping them busy is a good thing to do. I always thought that one of the best strategies to make sure my kids didn't get into trouble was to make sure that they were very, very busy. So, anyways, that's just my comment. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Robbins? Okay, thank you, Mr. Robbins. We're not seeing any questions. Appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
We did have Carrie Kerrigan on the list as potential invited testimony, but I do not see him online at this time. And so before opening it up to public testimony, we'll just comment that there are some folks available for questions. Aliza Muse from Department of Health and Social Services, Alyssa Wooden from Division of Behavioral Health, and then here in the audience, Dr. Jay Butler. So I don't know if anybody has any questions for any of those individuals, but they are available. And also Thomas Azarella from the Alaska After School Network, who spoke at the first meeting, is also online for questions if anyone has any. Okay, so seeing none, we'll go ahead and open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on House Bill 296? Seeing none, and I believe we've covered everyone online, and again, these other individuals are here available for questions. Mr. Azarella, is there anything that you'd want to add in based on comments that were made today? He's the only other non-state person.
Yes, thank you, Smithsonian Chair. This is Thomas Azarella, AZBARELLA. I just wanted to respond back in regards to, I believe it was Rep. Johnson's question in regards to the need for a grant application and that step approach. We know right now with the Department of Education's 21st Century Grant funded after school program, so that is the federal after school grant program. Currently for every one application, we're able to fund in state using those federal dollars. There are two applications that are going unfunded, so there is definitely a significant need in state. Additionally, we are seeing an increased number of communities, including the MAPSU, who are really actively pursuing after school as the strategy to reduce risk behaviors and create a comprehensive approach to addressing opioid and substance use and misuse in their region. So, I just wanted to kind of add that last bit, and we do definitely see that there is a need in terms of that funding allotment, and that we're seeing an increased number of communities really turning towards after school as part of that comprehensive approach to substance use prevention.
Any questions? Representative Solomon Leonard.
Hi, you made reference to MAPSU. You said especially in MAPSU. Can you highlight that a bit for me?
Yes, so right now the MAPSU Health Foundation, as well as United Way of MAPSU, as well as the school district and several community partners have been organizing the last year to really look at a comprehensive way of approaching substance use, and have really noted after school as a critical piece for that. I believe Dr. Butler during his testimony also spoke about recently a group from Alaska, including myself and several folks from the MAPSU, and Dr. Butler went over to Iceland to study their youth in Iceland model, which helped lead the way really for Iceland now to have the lowest youth substance rates in Europe. They dropped their use rates significantly over a 20-year period, and that was largely contributed to their engagement of youth during out-of-school time through after-school sports and after-school programming, as well as additional kind of family protective supports and other kind of key factors. So the MAPSU Health Foundation was one of the kind of drivers along with United Way of that group, and they've been actively applying for grant opportunities that are larger national federal grants that we are trying to secure for the MAPSU to address that kind of need of service, especially in regions such as the Northern Sioux, where we know that for many young people, they're left at home for a long time until their parents arrive back from work, and that there's just a lot of disconnection among youth because of the distance from school to home. So we're really looking at trying to address those need areas, with the MAPSU being one of our areas that has probably one of the lowest concentration of after-school programs.
Very good. Thank you.
Very good. And Representative Eastman, I think, had a question.
I do have a question through the chair, and I don't know who on the list would be best to direct this to, but I'm sure there's someone. Now, I know when the initiative passed almost 4 years ago, the idea, or at least much of the argument for passage, was that marijuana ought to be treated more like alcohol in terms of regulation rather than just making it illegal. And I'm wondering, when it comes to taxes on alcohol, how are alcohol taxes currently treated? And how, you know, what's the difference between that and what's being recommended to the committee today here in this bill?
Perhaps one of the folks from the department or Dr. Butler would want to speak to that. I mean, I know we have the fund, and we've talked about that a little bit in the budget. That's where some of the tax dollars go. Okay, let's see. We have Aliza online, and Ms. Muse, is that a question that you would be able to talk to, or Ms. Wooden from Division of Behavioral Health? Would one of you be able to take that Representative Eastman's question about how the alcohol tax is currently used?
Sure. This is Aliza Muse of the Department of Health and Social Services, through the chair, Representative Eastman. This fund is modeled similar to the Alcohol and Drug Fund, which is funded through the alcohol tax. That's pretty much all I kind of am aware of in regards to that fund. I know that fund does support services offered through the Division of Behavioral Health.
And follow up?
Sure.
Also through the chair. And do we know, does anyone know, you know, here we're currently recommended to allocate 100% of the marijuana taxes here so that none of it goes to the general fund. Is that similarly the case when it comes to the alcohol taxes?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that's beyond my scope at this point, but I'm happy to look into that further for you if you would like.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Keto.
Thank you, through the chair. And I guess just kind of an overall question, one of the things that I am concerned about is we used to have a Boys and Girls Club here and a pretty active after-school program. We don't have a extremely active after-school program here in Juneau. And I'm not aware how Haynes and Skagway and Gustavus are faring as far as after-school programs are concerned. So I guess what I'd want to know is this money that's coming into this program, how is that money going to be distributed to work on prevention programs for our smaller rural communities?
And perhaps Mr. Azzarella could speak to that. I think he'd be involved in the grant-making part of it.
Yes, the Chair. This is Thomas. So right now, if you are interested in kind of getting an inventory of what after-school programs are, we have a map that is available on akafterschool.org that highlights after-school programs throughout the state of Alaska. What we know in regards to the ability of the Children's Trust to be a grantor, so the Children's Trust, again, has over 20 years of history in the state of being that kind of public-private funder. And what I would say is it really allows us, by being inside of a nonprofit arena, is that we're able to be adaptable and flexible based on needs. So we're able to give grants that are based on the need for communities and for program expansion. So whether that is a small rural community that may be only engaging you know, a handful of students, or whether it is our largest cities here in Alaska, that we're able to be flexible in the grant-making process. I think that is one of the things right now that we are really looking at, is really one of the biggest challenges for many other after-school grant funding opportunities, is that our rural programs just don't have a really a viability chance for a lot of those grant programs because of just the number of students in their community. That doesn't make those communities any less of need. If anything, I'd say makes many of those rural communities a higher priority of need for after-school services for youth. But unfortunately, current grant funding opportunities typically kind of wave towards the urban centers. So it's really our hope with Alaska Children's Trust being the facilitator of the grant fund is to be able to ensure that greater rural equity and really be able to be nimble with the funding to be able to support community-based solutions to address the greater need.
Any follow-up?
Oh, follow-up, yeah. And I guess that seemed like kind of a roundabout. It sounds like you're saying that you don't have plans for rural at this point, but you hope that will happen at some point in the future?
What I would say is that there are after-school programs right now in lots of rural communities. And so that would be looking at trying to expand services that are already provided, such as the testimony that Ms. Humphreys gave from Boys and Girls Club. Many of those programs are located are currently in rural communities. Oftentimes, it is a lack of funding inside of rural communities that has prevented those services from being able to either continue on or expand to serve more kids. The hope of this fund is to be able to get funding specifically throughout the state in areas of highest need. We are in the process of doing another level of mapping of programs, really to be able to determine program density, to really be able to start finding those areas of highest needs in our state.
Follow up.
Continue.
Thank you. And I did review the map, and I guess I'm seeing quite a deficit of programs in the interior of the state, with the exception of Fairbanks. And then I do see that there are programs in Juneau, but no other programs in the other parts of northern southeast. And I guess I'm just saying that if we're taking half of the money from marijuana for marijuana education, and I think we should be making a very concerted effort to reach beyond just the urban communities or the communities that already have after-school programs. I'm concerned that we don't have a strategy or a goal to try and expand that outreach other than the hope and a prayer, I guess. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Mr. Azarella, did you have any comment on that?
Yeah, one, we look at the Southeast communities, so there are programs throughout the Southeast. Additionally, to this inventory map that you're seeing, this was our first ever inventory of the state. Previous to this inventory in 2016, we had no idea where out-of-school time programs were, which is one of the things frequently that we are getting calls about throughout the state about families trying to find services for their kids during out-of-school time. I agree there's definitely a deficit of programming throughout especially the northern southeast area throughout the interior and other regions. We know that there are some activities that are happening. We define programs as something that meets at least three or more times a week for at least over an hour and a half each session, opposed to an activity that might be happening once a week. While those after-school activities are critical and important, We know that in terms of building protective factors and reducing risk behavior, the duration and frequency of that dosage piece is really critical. So what we'd like to see inside of areas like the Southeast, I'll use Cordova as an example, Cordova or even going down to Metlakatla that has an after-school club that's starting to happen in Forum, is that right now they just have no funding to be able to do that. So they're relying entirely off of volunteers, and oftentimes it's a school teacher who is just staying after school and has an open classroom. So what we're really hoping to be able to do is help enhance those activities that are happening. Maybe once a week it might be a robotics program or a chess club, to be able to expand those services so that kids are able to stay engaged, so that they're there multiple times a week to be able to, again, increase that protective factor.
Okay, any other questions? I will just say, as we were waiting, because I was curious myself, on the Department of Revenue website, it says the Department of Revenue's tax division deposits all alcohol beverage tax revenue into the general fund. The Department of Administration separately accounts for 50% of the tax collected and deposits it into the alcohol and other drug abuse treatment and prevention fund. So I think in that sense they're going to be a little bit similar. And the last time we updated that was in 2002, and that's when that fund was actually created. And it's to go for funding for alcohol and drug abuse treatment programs, if that's helpful. Are there any other individuals who want to testify? Okay. Seeing no more individuals wishing to testify, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. And now we'll go to amendments. Do any members have amendments they'd like to offer? Mulling it over, but no at this time, it looks like. I think the intention today was to move the bill out of committee if there's no objection to that. So if there are no amendments, then at this time I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Madam Acting Chair, I move House Bill 296, Work Order 30/LS0537. Let me restate that. Work Order 30-LS0537/I from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
I object.
Okay. Do you want to speak to your objection?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember fairly vividly what, you know, some of the arguments that were made to the public when it came time to pass this initiative to move us from marijuana that was completely illegal to this tax and regulate. And I think many of those who were convinced that that initiative was worth supporting did so under the understanding that we would be regulating and we would be taxing, and some of those taxes would end up going to the general fund. And I think if they had then heard the argument which is being proposed now, that those funds would not be going to the general fund, that they would be going, effectively 100% of them, to things such as preventing marijuana use and treatment, I think that would have been a very different argument. I'm not sure the outcome would have been the same. So I'm not prepared to support this proposal as currently stated.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. Kind of in that same vein, I just don't think we're ready for this yet. I think when you look back on how the alcohol tax has been put into programs for treatment and what have you, that's been overextended. And for that, you're kind of setting a precedence then for any other tax that you would impose where the funds would go towards treatment or even for after-school programs. I know there are also other grants out there for Boys and Girls Club and other after-school programs that, you know, may actually come from the private sector or even, you know, our healthcare facilities. I'm sure Providence has a program they would like to assist the Boys and Girls Club with, as opposed to using this particular tax to be trickled down then into those programs. Again, I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we've had the time to let this amount of money get established to see how much is actually going to be collected. And the other part of it, too, is on the receiving end, there may be an expectation that so many millions of dollars are going to be continually pass through to different programs. And, you know, really, is that fair to them if that particular tax is not a staple part of the general fund? So, again, I just don't think we're there yet, and I don't support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard. Appreciate the comments. Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you. I'm mixed on this bill. I actually would support anything that keeps schools or facilities open from 6 in the morning till 6 at night, because I feel that children are very resilient, and if they're kept busy, even if their maybe their home life isn't the best, they can actually survive a lot. And so I'm always interested in anything that does a better job with that. I'm glad that this has appropriation up to, and at some point I might be thinking of doing an amendment, but for this vote, I will vote to move it out of committee, to go to this next committee.
Representative Keto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just say, despite the issues I have regarding programs for rural communities, I do think that there is some good intent here, and I have no objection to moving the bill out of committee.
Thank you, Representative Keto. Representative Edgen?
Yeah, and I just wanted to speak in support of the bill as well, and I my comments and my remembrance of the debate in 2014 differ significantly from two members from the Matsu Valley, and maybe that's me, but I remember this debate, a lot of the money going towards education and towards keeping kids away from marijuana and so forth, and frankly, I couldn't think of a more nobler purpose than this money going to this fund. I don't wish to pick a fight or nothing, but I just want to put on the record my viewpoint is highly in contrast to what I just heard a bit ago. So I'm going to support it.
Thank you. And I guess since everybody took a turn, I'll just weigh in. you know, I am more on the activity side of things, like Representative Johnston said, than just on the education, because we know, for example, the DARE program didn't accomplish what we had hoped it would, but that the activities that give kids other things to do. So I hope that's where this will go when these dollars become available, that it'll keep them busy from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and then they can eat and go to bed, and then they won't have any time to get in trouble. So so with that, I will also support this going from committee. So is the objection maintained?
Yes.
Okay. Could we please call the roll?
Representative Keto.
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
No.
Representative Johnston.
Yes.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
No.
Chair Sullivan's not here. Representative Tarr.
Yes.
40 yeas, 2 nays.
So with a vote of 4 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 296 passes from committee. We'll take an at ease to sign the paperwork. At 4:01 p.m., the remainder of today's schedule was going to be House Bill 268, but we are going to set that bill aside for hearing on Thursday. And so that will complete the work we have for today. If there are any closing comments from members? Okay, seeing none, then we will adjourn the meeting at 4:02 p.m.